Lecture 5 of Practical Advice to Teachers by Rudolf Steiner, given on August 26, 1919. We have already discussed how the first lesson in school should begin. Obviously, I cannot go on to describe every step, but I would like to indicate the essential course the lesson should take in a way that will enable you to put some of what I say into practice. We attached the greatest importance first to telling the children why they come to school, and then to making them aware that they have hands. When they have grasped these two ideas, we should start with drawing, and even make the transition to painting, through which a sense for what is beautiful and not so beautiful can be developed. We saw that this emerging understanding will also be found in hearing, leading to the first elements of a musical sense for what is more beautiful and less beautiful. Let us now turn to the next step. We shall assume that you have continued for a while in the exercises with crayons and paints. If what is learned is to be built on good foundations, it is essential that learning to write be preceded by concentration on drawing, so that writing can to some extent be derived from drawing. It is also essential that reading print be derived from reading handwriting. We will try to find the transition from drawing to writing, from writing to reading handwriting, and from reading handwriting to reading print. Let us assume that you have reached the stage where the children are finding their feet in drawing, and have mastered, to some extent, how to make the curved and straight forms that will be needed in writing. We now seek the transition to what we have described as the basis for writing and reading lessons. Today I will start with a few examples of how you might proceed. We assume that the children have reached the point where they can master straight and curved lines with their little hands. You then try to show them that there are such things as letters, a whole lot of them. We started with the fish and F. The sequence you follow is quite immaterial, and you need not proceed in alphabetical order. I will do so now merely so that you will have some sort of comprehensive record. Let us see what success we have in evolving writing and reading out of your own free imagination. I would now say to the children, quote, "You know what a bath is," unquote. Let me here interject another point. It is very important in teaching to be cunning in a rational manner, that is, always to have something up your sleeve that can contribute unseen to the children's education. In this sense, it is good to use the word bath for the step I am about to describe, so that while they are in school, the children are reminded of a bath, of washing themselves, of cleanliness as such. It is good always to have a hidden purpose in the background without actually mentioning it or masking it in admonishments. It is helpful to choose examples that compel the children to think of things that might also contribute to a moral and aesthetic attitude. Then you continue, quote, "You see, when grown-ups want to write down what a bath is, they do it like this, B-A-T-H, bath. This is the picture of what you express when you say bath, and mean a bath," unquote. Now I again let a number of the children copy this word, just copy it. Whenever they are given a concept like this, it should go straight into their hands, so that they take it in not just by looking, but with their whole being. Then I say, quote, "Watch how you start to say bath. Let us look at the beginning of the word bath, B." The children have to be led from saying the whole word bath to just breathing the initial sound, as I illustrated with the fish. The next thing to make clear to them is that just as bath is the sign for the whole bath, so B is the sign for the beginning of the word bath. Then I explain that a beginning like this can also be found in other words. I say, quote, "If you say band, you also start like this. If you say bow, like the bow, like the bow some people wear in their hair, you again start in the same way." Have you ever seen a bear in the zoo? When you begin to say bear, you breathe the same sound. All these words start with the same sound, unquote. In this way, I try to lead the children from the whole word to the beginning of the word by finding the transition to the single sound or letter, always taking the initial letter from the whole word. It is important that you yourself try to develop the initial letter in a meaningful way out of the drawing element. You will achieve this very well if you simply use your imagination. Just think that the people who first saw such animals as beavers and bears drew the animal's back with its hind paws on the ground and its forepaws lifted up. They drew an animal in the act of rising on its hind legs, and their drawing turned into a capital B. You will always find that the initial letter of a word is a drawing, an animal or plant form or some external object. You can give your imagination free rein. There is no need to delve into cultural histories which are incomplete in any case. The fact is that if you go back in history to the most ancient forms of Egyptian writing, which was still a type of sign writing, you will find many copies of objects and animals in the letters. Not until the transition from the Egyptian to the Phoenician culture did the change take place that brought about the development of the picture into a sign representing a sound. It is this transition that the children must experience anew. Let us therefore gain a clear idea of the theory of it ourselves. When writing first began to develop in ancient Egypt, every detail that was written down was written in picture writing. It was drawn, although the drawing had to be as simplified as possible. If someone employed in copying this picture writing made a mistake, if, for instance, a holy word was misrepresented, the scribe was condemned to death. We thus see how very, very seriously anything connected with writing was taken in ancient Egypt. All writing at that time consisted of pictures of this kind. Then cultural life was taken up by the Phoenicians, who lived more firmly in the external world. They retained the initial picture of a word and transferred it to represent the sound. Since we are not here to study Egyptian languages, let me give you an example that is valid for Egyptian and also easily adapted to our own language. The Egyptians knew that the form of the upper lip could depict the sound for M. They therefore took the sign for the letter M from the picture of the upper lip. From this sign, the letter that we use for the beginning of the word mouth emerged, and the letter is also valid for any other word beginning with the same sound. In this way, the picture sign for the beginning of a word became the sign for a sound. Because this principle was adhered to in the history and development of writing, it is also excellent for teaching, and we shall use it here. We shall endeavor to arrive at letters by starting with drawings. Just as we move from the fish with its two fins to the F, and from the bear dancing on its hind legs to the capital letter B, so we move from the upper lip to the mouth, and from the mouth to the capital letter M. With our imagination, we seek to pave the way for the child from drawing to writing. I told you that it is unnecessary to make extensive studies of the history of writing in order to find what you need. What you might discover through such studies will serve you far less in your teaching than what you find through your own soul activity and your own imagination. The kind of writing necessary for studying the history of writing would make you so dead that you would have a far less living influence on your students than you will have if you yourself arrive at the idea of deriving the bee from the bear. Working things out for yourself will refresh you so much that what you tell your students will have a far more living effect than lesson material you find through historical research. Looking at life and your teaching with these two aspects in mind, you must ask yourselves which is more important. Is it to take in a historical fact with great effort, and then strenuously seek to weave it into your lessons, or to have such agility of soul that you can invent your own examples to offer your students with your own enthusiasm? It will always give you joy, albeit a quiet joy, to transfer to a letter the shape you have made yourself out of some animal or plant, and your joy will live in what you make out of your student. Next, we point out to the children that what they have found at the beginning of a word can also appear in the middle. You say, for instance, quote, "You have all seen a little baby. When grown-ups want to write the word baby, they do it like this, B-A-B-Y. Here you can see that what you had at the beginning in bear is now at the beginning and in the middle, in baby." Unquote. Rudolf Steiner used the German word Rebe, vine, as his example here, so I have freely adapted his meaning to an English word. End of footnote. You always use uppercase letters in the beginning so that the children can see the similarity to the picture. Oh, that was footnote, end quote, sorry. You always use uppercase letters in the beginning so that the children can see the similarity to the picture. In this way you teach them that what they have learned from the beginning of a word can also be found in the middle of a word. This is another step in the process of dividing the whole into parts for them. You see that the important point for us in our endeavor to achieve a living rather than a dead teaching is always to start from the whole. Just as in arithmetic we start not from the addenda but from the sum, which we divide into parts, so here too we proceed from the whole to the parts. The great advantage of this method of teaching is that we are thus able to place the children in the world in a living way. The world is a totality, and the children maintain permanent links with the living whole if we progress as I have indicated. Having them learn the individual letters from pictures gives them a link with living reality. But you must never neglect to write the letter forms in such a way that they are seen to arise from the pictures. And you must always take into account that the consonants can be explained as pictures of external objects, but never the vowels. Your point of departure for the vowels is that they always render the inner being of human beings and their relationship to the external world. For example, when you are teaching children the letter ah, you will say, quote, "Think of the sun you see in the morning. Can any of you remember what you did when the sun rose this morning?" Perhaps some of the children will remember what they did. If none of them remember, they will have to be helped to recall how they must have stood there, and if the sunrise was very beautiful, they must have said, "Ah." A note of feeling must be struck, calling forth the resonance that sounds in the vowel. Then you must try to tell them that when they stood like that and said, "Ah," it was just as if a beam of sunlight from their inner being spread out from their mouths. And then he has actually an angle pointing downward and with arrows on the ends of the two respective rays. And then next to that he has the two downward angles, and he's put a line in the center, of course, to show a capital A. That which lives in you when you see the sunrise streams forth out of your inner being when you say ah, drawing on left. But if you do not let all of it stream out, you keep some of it back, and it becomes this sign, drawing on right. You should try to clothe, in the form of a drawing, what lies in the breath when a vowel is spoken. You will find drawings that can show, in a picture, how the signs for the vowels have come about. Primitive cultures do not have many vowels, not even the primitive cultures of today. The languages of primitive cultures are very rich in consonants. These people can express many more things in consonants than we know how to express. They even click their tongues and are skilled in articulating all sorts of complicated consonants with only a hint of vowel sounds between. You will find African tribal people who make sounds resembling the crack of a whip and so on, while the vowels are only faintly heard. European travelers who meet these tribes usually sound their vowels much more strongly than the tribal peoples do. We can always evolve the vowels out of drawing. For instance, by appealing to the children's feelings, you can try to make them imagine themselves in the following situation. Quote, "Think what would happen if your brother or sister came to you and said something you did not understand at first. After a while, you begin to understand what is meant. Then what do you say?" One of the children may answer, or you may have to point out, that they would say, "E," I in German. Unquote. When we draw the shape of the sound E, it seems to point toward what has been understood, though it is a somewhat rough expression. In eurythmy, you find it expressed very clearly. A simple line becomes I. I'm going to say the letter I. The line should be fatter at the bottom and thinner at the top, but instead we draw a line and express the thinner part with a smaller sign above it. In this way, every vowel can be derived from the shape of the aspiration out of the breath. Using this method, you will at first be teaching the children a kind of sign writing. You need not feel constrained about employing ideas that arouse feelings that really did live in the process of cultural development. You could say, quote, "Have you ever seen a tall building with a dome on top?" Footnote, Rudolf Steiner's example here is Dach, roof. Dome fits the letter D so well that I've used it here and very slightly altered the text accordingly. Translator. End of footnote. A dome, D. You would have to make the D like this, and then it's like a upside-down U with a line under it. This writing seemed awkward, however, so people upended it and made D. Such ideas really are inherent in writing, and you can make use of them. Now you proceed to the lowercase letters. You say, quote, "After a while, people did not want their writing to be so complicated. They wanted it to be simpler. So out of this sign, D, which really ought to be upside-down U with a bottom line, they made this sign, the lowercase d. You can most certainly evolve the existing letter shapes in this way out of figures you have taught the children in drawing. By always pointing out the transition from form to form, and never teaching in an abstract way, you help the children progress so that they can find the genuine transition from the form derived from the drawing to the shape of the actual letter in handwriting. There are some individuals today who have recognized such things, though they are rare. There are educators who have pointed out that writing ought to be derived from drawing, but they proceed in a different manner from the one recommended here. Their starting point is the shape of the letters as they are today, instead of proceeding from the sign for the dancing bear to the B. They try to lead the children from drawing to writing by cutting the B into separate lines and curves, straight line upside down and a side D. They advocate an abstract version of what we are trying to do concretely. These educators are quite right in seeing that it would be practical to proceed from drawing to writing, but people today are too entangled in the deadwood of our culture to hit upon a clearly living way of going about things. Let me warn you at this point not to be taken in by all sorts of modern endeavors that might tempt you to say that efforts are being made here and there to do this and that, for you will always discover that the intentions do not have very deep foundations. Somehow people are constantly impelled to attempt such things, but they will not succeed until humankind has accepted spiritual science as a part of culture. We can always make a connection between the human being and the surrounding world by teaching writing in an organic way, and teaching reading by starting with reading handwriting. It is natural to teaching that there is a certain yearning for complete freedom, and we should not dismiss this element. Notice how freedom flows into this discussion of how we might prepare ourselves to be teachers. Our discussion intrinsically has something to do with freedom. I have pointed out that you should not fetter yourselves by toiling away at studying how writing came into being during the transition from Egyptian to Phoenician culture, that you must develop your own soul capacities. What can be done by this method of teaching will differ from teacher to teacher. Not everyone can use a dancing bear. Someone might use a better example for the same purpose. One teacher, however, can achieve the final result just as well as another. All teachers give of themselves when they teach. In this, their freedom remains inviolate. The more teachers desire to preserve their freedom, the more they will be able to enter into their teaching by giving themselves. This capacity has been almost entirely lost in recent times, as you can see from a certain example. Some of you who are younger may not remember a certain incident, but it very much annoyed some older people who understood its implications. Some time ago, preparations were made to create something culturally very much like introducing the famous, quote, official German gravy, unquote, in the material realm. You know that it has often been stressed that there should be a standardized sauce or gravy for all inns that serve only Germans and do not have to deal with a select foreign clientele. Well, spelling was supposed to be standardized, just as they would this, quote, official German gravy, unquote. People have the strangest attitude toward the matter of standardization, as real examples show. There is in German literature an instance of a most beautiful, tender relationship between Novalis and a certain lady. Footnote, Novalis, 1772 to 1801, was born Friedrich von Hardenberg, was a German poet who, after losing his 14-year-old fiancée, wrote 6 prose poems interspersed with verse, entitled Hymns to the Night. End of footnote. This relationship is so beautiful because when the lady in question passed away, Novalis continued to live with her quite consciously in the spiritual world, following her through death in an inner meditative activity of soul. He bore witness to this. The relationship between Novalis and his beloved is one of the most entrancing and intimate episodes in the history of German literature. A certain German scholar wrote a highly intelligent and, seen from its own point of view, also interesting, strictly philological treatise on the relationship between Novalis and the lady. This delicate, tender relationship is, quote, put in its proper light, unquote, through the proof that the lady died before she had learned to spell properly. She made spelling mistakes in her letters. In short, we are given, with the strictest scientific accuracy, of course, a thoroughly banal picture of this person who had such a special relationship with Novalis. The scientific method is so good that any dissertation made in accordance with it would earn the highest marks. I only want to remind you that people seem to have forgotten that Goethe was never able to spell properly, that all through his life he made spelling mistakes, particularly when he was young. Despite this, he rose to Goethean greatness. And this is not to mention the people he knew and thought highly of. Their letters, nowadays sometimes published in facsimile, would earn nothing but red corrections from the hand of a schoolmaster. They would get very poor marks. All this is linked to a rather unfree aspect of our lives. Let me read that again. All this is linked to a rather unfree aspect of our lives, an aspect that ought to play no part in education. Only a few decades ago, it was so pronounced that the more enlightened teachers were infuriated. Standard German spelling, the well-known Puttkamer orthography, was to be introduced. This meant that the state not only exercised the right to supervise and administer the schools, but actually laid down the law on spelling. The result is just what you might expect. The Puttkamer spelling system has robbed us of much that might still have revealed a feeling for the more intimate aspects of the German language. Seeing only today's abstract spelling, people have lost much in written German of what used to live in the German language. The proper attitude of mind matters most in such circumstances. Obviously, we cannot let spelling run riot, but we can at least recognize the opposite points of view. If people, once they had learned to write, were allowed to put down what they heard from others just as they heard it, or what came from within them, their spelling would be extremely varied, exceedingly individualized. This would make communication more difficult, but it would be extraordinarily interesting. On the other hand, our task is to develop not only our own individuality in community with others, but also our social impulses and feelings. A great deal of what could be revealed as our own individuality is expunged in what we have to develop for the sake of living together with others. We should feel that this is so. We should be taught to feel that we do such a thing purely for social reasons. Therefore, when you begin to orient your writing lessons toward spelling, your starting point must be a quite specific set of feelings. You will again and again have to point out to the children, as I have already said earlier, that they should respect and esteem grown-ups, that they are themselves growing up into a world already formed and waiting to receive them, and that therefore they must take notice of what is already there. This is a point of view from which children must be introduced to subjects like correct spelling. Spelling lessons must run parallel with developing feelings of respect and esteem for what their predecessors have established. Spelling must not be taught as an abstraction, as though it existed as an absolute on the basis of some divine, or if you will, Puttkamer, law. You must develop in the children the feeling that the grown-ups, whom we are to respect, spell like this, and we ought to follow their example. Variability in spelling will result, but it will not be excessive. The growing child will make a certain adaptation to the world of the grown-ups, and we must count on this adaptation. It is not our task to create in children the belief that this is right and that is wrong. The only belief we should arouse, thus building on living authority, is that this is the way grown-ups do it. This is what I meant when I said we must find the transition from the child's first stage of life up to the change of teeth, to the second stage, up to puberty, by making the transition from the principle of imitation to that of authority. These ideas must be introduced everywhere, in practice, not by drilling the children to respect authority, but by acting in a way that will help foster their feeling for authority, for instance, by teaching spelling in the way I have just described. That is the end of Lecture 5.